Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
The state health department says the first two cases of the P1 variant have been detected here in Colorado.
A new variant dubbed the double mutant.
The variant first spotted in the UK that's now in all 50 states, including here in Tennessee.
Growing concerns of a contagious COVID variant that is making, in particular, young people sick around the country.
Highly contagious COVID-19 variant.
We just aren't going to be able to get enough people vaccinated quickly enough to keep the rest of the country from experiencing much of what we're seeing in the upper Midwest and Northeast.
Variants everywhere in news headlines and as a factor in the pandemic now. So let's push beyond those anxiety-inducing headlines and do some deep learning today about variants. What are they? How do they work? How do we protect people from them? And we're going to invite back some experts in all things pandemic and virus-related. You've heard them a couple of times on the show over the past year. Angela Rasmussen joins us. She's a virologist at the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University. Angie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me back, Meghna.
And also with us is Tara Smith, epidemiologist at Kent State University in Ohio. Tara, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so I will classify variants as the latest thing after R-naughts and spike proteins that everyone all of a sudden pretends they know a lot about, but very few of us are actually experts in. So help us answer some questions, guys. Here's the first question we received. Well, not the first, but one of the most common questions we received from On Point listeners about variants. This is Paul McSherry wondering this from Marshfield, Massachusetts.
I just received the one Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And I know it came out a little later than Pfizer and Moderna. Have any of the vaccines been tested in their effectiveness vis-a-vis the variants? And just some more information about that would be useful.
Angie Rasmussen, this is the most common question we've received. So do the vaccines work against the variants?
So the short answer is yes, they do. And like Paul, I also this past week received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And a lot of people were concerned because part of the Johnson & Johnson trials were conducted in South Africa, where the B.1.351 variant is circulating commonly. What that study found was that efficacy of overall was a little bit reduced when that variant was present. But overall, the vaccine remains very, very protective against severe disease, hospitalization, and death. Really, in the trials, it was 100% effective against those more severe negative outcomes. So I think that, and we've seen similar data come in for all of the other vaccines that are currently authorized in the U.S. Pfizer and Moderna also work against the variants. It's also important to note that there really isn't that reduction, even slight reduction in overall efficacy for the B.1.1.7 variant first discovered in the UK that is now considered the dominant variant in the US.
Okay.
So people can rest assured, even though they may have seen some lab results that suggest that some antibodies are less capable of neutralizing these viruses, in the real world, the vaccines work against the variants.
Okay, so that's the takeaway. The vaccines work against the variants. And when we say work, we mean keeps you out of the hospital, keeps you alive, and also maybe helps you avoid serious illness. Is that right? Is that what work means in this case?
That's correct. And actually, I mean, the slight reduction in overall efficacy, meaning its ability to protect you against any type of symptomatic COVID, was a very, very slight reduction. It was a matter of a few percentage points. So the vaccines really do work pretty well against all of the variants.
Okay. But we still have a lot of questions about various aspects of what being vaccinated means in the face of the variants. Here's Jeff Brown wondering this from Lincoln, Nebraska.
Among empty nest adults who are fully vaccinated and want to return to meeting together weekly indoors unmasked, does the presence of these variants, does that make that activity more unsafe.
Tara, how do you answer Jeff's question?
Yeah, good question. I would say it's not really that much more unsafe than what we've already seen. So the CDC has already put out guidelines looking at gathering of individuals who are fully vaccinated with each other. Generally, they recommend it's limited to, you know, just a few households. So again, if you're having a large group of individuals, the more people you bring in, that does increase your risk. But as long as everyone is fully vaccinated, the risk is still very low. And we have seen this in, you know, in the real world, also in studies in Israel that was recently published, where they had the B.1.1.7 variant circulating and still had very high vaccine effectiveness. And that is the one that is becoming dominant in the U.S. So that's the one we're most concerned about here. But I don't think that really reduces or really increases the risk of unvaccinated people gathering together, because again, the vaccines do still work very well against that variant.
Okay, so that's the biggest takeaway from the first round of questions. The vaccines are effective or work very well, to quote you, on against the variants. Now, folks, we are talking to a couple of experts here today about everything you wanted to know about variants, because they are all over the news right now. And we want to, again, as I said, get to that place of deeper learning. So if you've got a question, as our conversation unfolds, hop over to social media. And we're on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And send us your question. And Tara and Angie, they're already coming in. And you both have mentioned some of the names or the designations of the variants. And I think that's the next logical place for us to go, because someone calling themselves Freedom to Be says, please, 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 please list the variants and point us to some information that discusses all of them or most. My science nerd itch needs scratching. Okay, so Angie, as far as I understand, there are three particular variants that are of chief concern in the United States now. Is that right?
Well, there are actually more now.
Oh, great.
And we've been hearing about them. But I think the three that you're referring to are B.1.1.7. That is the variant that was first discovered in the UK late last year. That is thought to be the most prevalent variant that's currently circulating in the U.S. right now. B.1.1.7 is thought to be more transmissible. It's also thought to be more pathogenic. It will increase your risk of being hospitalized or potentially dying if you are infected with it. And so that's what we're chiefly worried about right now. There's also the B.1.351 variant, first discovered in South Africa, and the P.1 variant, and actually the P.2 variant, which is a descendant of the P.1 variant that was first discovered in Brazil. There are cases of B.1.351 and P.1 in the United States. They are not as prevalent as B.1.1.7. These are variants that are thought to potentially have some capacity for evading some antibody responses. And then there is the B.1.427-429 variant. That's the so-called California variant that was detected in California. And then the B.1.526 variant, which was first detected in New York City. And locally, those variants have become prevalent in those areas where they were discovered. It's really unknown what their significance is, but they are thought to also potentially be capable of some immune evasion and may also be more transmissible.
This is making me feel less hopeful than I started the hour with.
Well, so here's the thing to think about all of this, right? Like, we don't, actually, for a lot of these variants, we have some limited laboratory data. We have some limited genomic surveillance and epidemiology data. But we really don't know if these are going to have any meaningful impact on the pandemic. And viruses really develop variants all the time. A lot of people are surprised to hear that there's actually thousands of variants that have been identified. Every time the virus replicates, it has the opportunity to acquire new mutations. And that's all a variant is. It's a virus that's acquired some mutations compared to the ancestral viruses that it arose from. So there's really only a handful of these variants that are so-called variants of concern or variants under investigation, variants that have mutations in places where we think they might have an impact on either transmission or on the ability to potentially partially evade immune responses. But I want to make sure that I'm really drilling this home that even variants that are capable of circumventing parts of the immune response are not likely to be able to circumvent the totality of the immune response, which is really involves a lot more than just neutralizing antibodies. So even though it sounds scary, and it sounds like there's where all these variants coming from, it's actually a normal expected process during a viral infection. Whenever a virus gets close to replicating, there are going to be a lot of variants that arise.
Yeah. We're going to, I don't know if you can hear this, Angie, but your line's kind of breaking up on us. We're going to get that fixed here because it's driving me a little nuts that we can't hear every single one of these very important words that you are saying. But Tara, let me turn back to you because listener Sun and Roses says, is there any correlation of the recent rise in new COVID cases in the U.S. To lack or immunity or lack thereof of these variants?
So somewhat, yes, because we are seeing these again in unvaccinated individuals. So it's not an immune escape. It's just the fact that we still have so many people that are susceptible to these. And we know that, again, especially with B.1.1.7, it seems to be more transmissible than the ancestral virus. So it's easier to spread. And as you've had places that have reduced some of their restrictions on masking and distancing, you have a lot more kids that are either back in school full time and are playing sports and are, you know, getting together in other ways, that's really what we're seeing as far as having the biggest impact on transmission. Because, you know, for kids, of course, anyone under the age of 16 cannot be vaccinated, period. And then we only have about, 20% of the U.S. that has been fully vaccinated, and those are mostly older populations and others who are at risk. So we still have a lot of people who are naive to this virus and who are very susceptible to being infected with it. So that's really what we're seeing. It's not kind of any kind of escape in those who have been vaccinated, but it's just the fact that we still have so many potential hosts for this virus, and that's why we're trying really hard to get vaccinations out there more quickly to those who can be vaccinated to try to slow the spread of this virus.
Well, we're talking with epidemiologist Tara Smith this hour and virologist Angela Rasmussen, getting some deep learning in on these COVID variants. What are they? How do they work? All your questions about variants, since they are all over the news. Send us your questions on Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. We'll be right back with more. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're doing a form of Variants 101, or everything you wanted to know about the COVID variants that are all over the news right now and seem to be a very important factor of this at this point in the pandemic globally and here in the United States. I'm joined today by Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at Georgetown's Center for Global Health Science and Security. She's joined us quite frequently over the course of this pandemic year plus, to help give us exchange our anxiety for actual knowledge. And she's back to help us do that now. And Tara Smith is also with us. She's a professor of epidemiology at Kent State University, also has joined us several times again to strengthen us with knowledge here rather than anxiety-inducing headlines. So Tara and Angie, just hang on here for a second, because now I want to bring in a third expert here. Mary Jo Ondrakin joins us. She's a professor of chemistry and chemical biology at Northeastern University, and her lab is studying proteins in SARS-CoV-2 variants. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. I'm a big fan of your show.
Well, I'm a big fan of smart scientists, so glad to have you with us. I actually kind of want to ask you a very, very elementary question to get started. And by the way, Tara and Angie, I just want all three of you to feel free to jump in with each other as we talk through these questions. But how do the variants get their names? Because B117, B1351, like how do they get their names? Mary?
I don't know how they get their names.
Okay. Angie, do you know?
I do. So there's several different naming systems. And the one that we're referring to now is called the Pango lineage. It was developed by Andrew Rambaugh, who is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Edinburgh. It basically refers to the descendants of an ancestral virus. So the virus that started all of this, so-called Wuhan 1, which is really the prototypic virus, that's the sequence that we look back to and say this is basically the virus that was there and circulating when the pandemic started. That is the A1 lineage. And as that virus has spread through the human population, new variants have emerged, as I was saying earlier, and hopefully you caught at least some of that despite my internet problems. And so as a result, descendants of that have come off. So then the B lineage arose, and that is the B117, B1351, et cetera. Those B1351, that refers to descendants within those other lineages. So B1351 is the 351st descendant of the B1 lineage.
Oh, I see.
And to make it even more confusing, P1 from Brazil is a descendant of the B1 lineage, but it's its own new evolutionarily distinct branch. Basically, it's like the start of a new lineage within that descended from the B1 lineage. So now they started calling that P1, P2, et cetera.
Okay. So you see, no question too basic. They all reveal interesting answers. I just got to listen to viral taxonomy there. Okay. Mary Jo, let me turn back to you. Your lab is studying proteins in these variants. What are you specifically looking at?
Well, we're looking at the motions and shapes of the spike protein. I think everyone has seen pictures of the coronavirus, the little spikes that stick out from the surface. Those are the spike proteins, and they bind to the human ACE2 receptor, and that's how they attack us. And so we're looking at what happens dynamically to these spike proteins. And in order to attach to ACE2 and infect the cell, they undergo a shape shift. Mm. They do a shape shift. And very early on in the pandemic, there was a variant, a substitution called D614G that makes that shape shift more possible or more happens more readily and thus more readily attaches to the ACE2 receptor on human cells. So these changes in the protein sequence change the protein structure and the shape of the protein. And some of these variants make it more easily invading human cells.
So is that, I guess in the class of variants that you're looking at, that's primarily what makes them different than that ancestral original SARS-CoV-2, that that spike protein is significantly different?
It has some amino acid changes. The B117 variant, I think of it as N501Y. It's the substitution makes it more prone to attach to human cells and invade human cells.
Okay, so again, no question too basic here, so forgive me if I'm bringing some basic questions. Tara and Angie in the first segment emphasized repeatedly that the vaccines are effective against these variants, right, Tara and Angie? Right. I'm not misquoting you. Okay,
you are not misquoting.
Okay, so help me understand the truth of that, Mary Jo, alongside the fact that what I thought was one of the key mechanisms by which the vaccines work in terms of mimicking the spike proteins or training the body to see those spike proteins, that it's those very spike proteins that are slightly different in the variants.
Yes. Well, yes. The vaccines currently contain the genetic information to make the spike protein, and then when you get the vaccine, your ribosomes then make the spike protein, and then your immune system says, "Oh no, we're being invaded," and makes antibodies, and the antibodies attach to the spike protein, and they line up just right to bind to the spike protein. And if you have too many amino acid substitutions on the surface, those antibodies won't stick. Now, all the evidence now suggests that the B117 variant the vaccine works just fine because that N501Y change is not enough to make the antibodies not stick. But if you start to have too many substitutions, so if you get too many mutations happening on the surface, then the vaccines are not going to work. So we're in a race. We've got to get the population vaccinated before the virus makes too many changes, and we need a whole new set of vaccines to combat the new viruses.
Right.
So we're in a race.
Okay. So Tara Smith, here's how I see where we are right now with this pandemic and the emergence of these variants. It's like, you know, it's like, say you have this giant aperture and you're trying to send something through, or you're trying to block things from going through, right? But like they might lumber through slowly, so you're trying to close that aperture down, and that's the vaccines. The more people we get vaccinated, the smaller that aperture becomes, right? And the less likely we're going to get infections through it. But these variants seem to be, as you said earlier, more transmissible and more pathogenic. So they just like kind of move faster through a population. Is that right?
Right, exactly. So that's why we have to really, you know, keep our guard up as far as wearing masks, distancing, and getting the vaccine as fast as possible. So I stole Angie's analogy, you know, that we're selling virus lottery tickets, and we need to stop doing that because eventually one of them is going to win. And the more hosts they have to evolve in, the more chances they have to, you know, stumble upon these mutations that could allow them to evade immunity, whether it is from vaccination or from natural infection. And so that's what we're really trying to stop here, by diminishing the number of hosts that are available for the virus through distancing, through masking, and through vaccination.
Okay, so we've got lots of questions coming in about things that folks are experiencing or seeing around the country. Andre wants to know what the explanation is for the surge in cases in places like Michigan and the significant decline in cases in Texas where there are less restrictions. Tara, do you have any insight on that?
Well, Michigan has a lot of the B117, and they reduced a lot of their restrictions about, 2 months ago or so, as far as, you know, restrictions on limits of people in restaurants and things like that. So they're pretty open there, and even though they still have some mask mandates, from what I hear from family that spend a lot of time in Michigan through their business, you know, a lot of people are not masking up. So I think it's a combination of some, you know, apathy as far as responding to the pandemic and some pandemic fatigue, the presence of these B117 variants, and also the biggest place that they're seeing outbreaks are in schools. So, and not necessarily within the classroom, but within sports settings and things like that, other places where these kids can congregate together. And they're spreading a lot of the virus. Last I checked, there was something like 300 distinct outbreaks in Michigan that were associated with schools. And it was the number one place that people are being infected, with number two being like industries like factories. So, well, you know, all of that has combined to just make a really bad situation in that state.
Okay. And Angie, Becky Romo wants to know, speaking of schools, what do the variants mean for children and schools if parents are vaccinated? If parents are vaccinated and if they're not, I presume, meaning the children are not.
So this is a great question. And I think this is something we really need to be thinking and talking about, because countries like Israel have shown us that a combination of vaccination in the population, the adult population, as well as certain restrictions when applied correctly. And in Israel, when they began their vaccination campaign, they had a pretty strict lockdown for the first month or so. If you get transmission down enough in the adult population through a combination of non-pharmaceutical interventions like lockdowns or restrictions or mask mandates, and you are vaccinating a significant proportion of the adult population, you can both reduce transmission and keep transmission down. If transmission is low enough in the community, then it probably will be safe to send kids back to school because there's just not a lot of virus around. If their teachers are vaccinated, if their parents are vaccinated, there's not going to be a lot of sustained transmission in those households, and it's going to be less likely that kids are going to get exposed. But until we have vaccines available for kids as well, we will always run the risk of having a large susceptible population of children congregating together. So we'll need to continue taking mitigation measures. We'll need to continue doing testing to detect outbreaks in the school setting and in the population of children until that population can be vaccinated as well. Now, for older kids, Pfizer recently released the data from a clinical trial in 12 to 15-year-olds suggesting that that vaccine is safe and it did produce robust immune responses in those kids. So it may be that we are going to be able to vaccinate those older kids at least sooner than later and possibly even in time for back to school in the fall. Younger kids, though, we probably won't be able to have any trial data to evaluate for the vaccine in that population until early 2022. So this is something we can do and we can do safely, but it has to be done very carefully. And we need to make sure the appropriate measures are in place to detect outbreaks when they happen.
You bet. Mary Jo, let me turn back to you because, again, we in the media, I'll just say it, I think sometimes just do a disservice to people by throwing around a lot of terms and not defining them for people. And another one that I've heard a lot recently is double mutant variants. And, of course, that sounds terrifying and scary. What does that mean, and are they distinctly different or more dangerous? Help us understand what double mutants are.
Well, double mutant means that the protein is a sequence of amino acids. And if it's a double mutant, that means it has two mutations. So the B1427 variant that was discovered in California has two mutations. But there are, I think the P1 variant is a fourfold mutation. It has four mutations, so it's a quadruple mutant. So just because it's a double mutant doesn't mean necessarily that it's worse.
Isn't that interesting? Okay, that's really it's absolutely interesting to me.
And Megan,
yeah, go ahead.
This is Angie. Can I jump in for 1 second too? What Mary just said was absolutely correct. And what people, I think, don't realize is all this scary double mutant talk is really presented by the media and not so much scientists. I don't know anybody who's running around saying, oh, my God, it's a double mutant. The B117 variant, for example, actually has 17 mutations throughout the genome compared to the ancestral sequence. So I don't even know how to say 17 upple. But all of these variants have more than one mutation. So double mutant doesn't really mean a whole lot.
We just need to stop. I mean, I must be in a mood this morning because when I say we, I mean the media, because I have heard this phrase double mutant so often. And I have, something of a scientific educational background, so it didn't freak me out. But I was like, why do we keep saying this? Because we're not helping people without explaining what it means. So, Mary Jo, look, we've got about 2 minutes left before we have to take a break here. I'm wondering, arm us with some questions to be thinking about. What are the questions that you're asking about the variants that you're studying? What is it that you want to know about them that'll help us, you know, as the human race, understand what potentially is coming next in the pandemic? What are some important questions we should be thinking about?
But we're looking at, what do individual amino acid substitutions do to the structure of the protein, to the dynamics of the protein? Does it shape shift better so that it attaches better? Does its affinity for the receptor, the human receptor, improve with the amino acid change? So those are the kind of questions that we're looking at, trying to understand why certain mutations make the virus more infective. I mean, these mutations happen at random, and some of them make the virus more infective. Some of them do nothing in terms of infectivity. Some of them make them less infective. But of course, the ones that are more infective are the ones that spread faster and start to take over.
And this is, so just to underscore another truth about the natural world, we got about 30 seconds here, Mary Jo. This is what happens with all viruses. They all just naturally undergo mutation. It's a fact of viral life in every disease we've ever seen in humankind.
Yes, and that's exactly why we as humans don't have a very good track record in terms of curing viral diseases. We have drugs that can lessen the duration and severity sometimes, but there's no cure for the common cold. If you look at herpes, influenza, there is no cure because these viruses mutate, and it's very, very hard to find something that will eradicate the virus. So we don't have a very good track record.
Well, it's that endless pathogenic arms race there. Mary Jo Ondrakin, professor of chemistry and chemical biology at Northeastern University, whose lab is currently studying SARS-CoV-2 variants. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be right back with a lot more. Everything you wanted to know about those variants, on point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On Monday's show, we're going to talk about the most intractable types of conflict, from political polarization to divorces to gang violence, and what those kinds of conflict have in common, and the tools to pry ourselves free from that kind of profound conflict, whether between two people or citizens of a nation. So we want to hear your stories of intense conflict. What lessons have you learned through those conflicts? What did it take to unwind from them? When conflict takes over your Facebook groups or Twitter feeds, have you been able to stop it? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today on the show, This is Variants 101 on Point. Everything you wanted to know about COVID variants that gets us beyond those anxiety-inducing headlines into a place of empowering knowledge. And I'm joined today by Tara Smith, professor of epidemiology at Kent State University. And Angela Rasmussen joins us as well. She's a virologist at Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. And Angie, I just couldn't resist. I looked it up. A 17-uple? Is a septendecibel, I think. A septendecibel.
Okay. I was going to say, it's probably septadeca hepta something.
It's either decibel or decouple, but it's septendecuple. So there we go.
Yeah, septadecouple.
Septadecouple. Thank you. All right. Learning every second of the show is always my goal. Okay. So we've talked about several of the variants, including the ones that have first identified in the UK, in South Africa, in Brazil, and a couple of them here in the United States. I wanted to just take a second to focus on what happened in South Africa. So just listen along with me, because Wilhelm Hannekom is the director of the Africa Health Research Institute in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. And he's been doing surveillance of COVID variants in South Africa using software to analyze the genetic code of samples of virus.
The genetic code is actually very, very simple. It's just a list of letters, okay? All the software does is it compares the list of letters of the new virus that you looked at compared to older viruses. And of course, the software is very clever in that it can analyze a whole lot of viruses at the same time.
After a COVID outbreak in South Africa's Eastern Cape region last August, Dr. Hannekom's colleague, Tulio de Oliveira, was given the task of analyzing the genetic code of coronavirus samples sent to their lab. And that's how he discovered the variant that came to be known as B1351.
He was very excited, but at the same time, extraordinarily concerned. He thought, what is going on here? You know, up till that time, we'd actually believed that although viruses change all the time, there have been relatively few changes of concern in coronaviruses to date. And suddenly, this virus appeared, and we thought, what's going on here? This became a variant of concern very quickly because it started overtaking all the other variants that were in South Africa, all the other viruses that were prevalent in South Africa. Literally within 2 or 3 months, it spread all over South Africa. And in fact, because you can look at the viruses in more detail than just whether they are variants or not, we could do epidemiological studies to show exactly how it spread from the Eastern Cape region to other provinces within South Africa. And that must tell us that there is incredible advantage for this virus over previous versions of this virus. And we know, therefore, that the virus spreads more easily. And it may also be that the virus causes slightly more severe disease, although that's not confirmed at the moment. If we didn't do the surveillance, we wouldn't have known that there are variants that are around, and we wouldn't have known that our vaccines may not work as well. And I think that many, many more variants are going to emerge if we do not control this epidemic. So we just need to know what the virus looks like to be able to design interventions against the viruses.
That's Wilhelm Hannekom, director of the Africa Health Research Institute. Tara Smith, let me ask you, he talked about the importance of surveillance in South Africa in terms of being able to identify that particular variant. What exactly do we mean by surveillance, and do we have it up to par here in the United States?
So what he means by surveillance is taking viral samples and sequencing them so we know what is happening at the genomic level with the virus, and what is happening not only in one place, but really around the country, so that we can identify those variants or others that we have seen and see how they are spreading in the country. So we can do that. In the United States, we are doing that. You asked if it's up to par, and I would say no. I would say that we are still far behind many other countries as far as the number of samples that we're sequencing, the percent of the population that is infected, that we are sequencing their samples, and not only getting that genomic information about the virus, which that itself is relatively easy, but trying to match that up with the characteristics of the person that the virus came from. That's really the harder part, is getting what we call metadata about the person the virus came from. So, you know, so for that, it takes a lot of kind of the epidemiological detective work. So, you know, where is this person from? What is their community? Who have they been in contact with? Mm-hmm. What is their age? You know, to look at the distribution of these variants in the population. That's the type of thing we really need to know in order to have confident data about how common these variants are, how they are spreading geographically, and again, whether they're more infectious or more deadly.
So that just to put a fine point on it, it sounds like surveillance is one of the things that you would like to see significant building up of here in the United States.
It is. And, you know, Biden promised that that would happen. I think it is starting to happen. I think there are plans for it to move forward, but everything is just slow. And again, some of those partnerships to be developed between like clinical laboratories, academic research laboratories, and public health departments, they just take time. And, you know, sometimes there are obstacles like getting access to medical records or things like that that are just not easy to circumvent.
Okay. So that's one of the lessons from South Africa, as we just heard. Let's actually take a quick look at Brazil, because as we discussed earlier, that P1 variant originally, I believe, identified in Brazil. It's driven up hospitalization rates and the death rate in Brazil, now seems to be spreading across South America. So we reached out to Terrence McCoy. He's the Washington Post bureau chief in Rio. And he said that Brazil and other South American countries are lacking the most important tool that the United States currently has, which is vaccines.
A lot of people want to get the vaccine. The issue is there is not enough vaccine at this point. It has been bogged down in delays, political infighting, just a lack of getting being able to get the vaccine. A lot of it goes back to just poor planning by the government. So right now, across Latin America, when you look at all of the cases, all the deaths, Latin America accounts for around 27% of the deaths in the pandemic, but has only applied 8% of the vaccines.
So really big difference there. And in March, as the P1 variant took hold, McCoy says the country reported 67,000 coronavirus deaths. That's in Brazil, more than any month of the pandemic in Brazil so far.
What's happened in Brazil is a warning to the world. It's a warning to what happens when government that is too laissez-faire about this collides with potentially more dangerous variants. Those two things can be an explosive combination, and we're seeing that in Brazil. The world would behoove itself to take note of that.
Angie Rasmussen, what do you think?
Well, I think that's absolutely correct. And one of the things I think that has been the most harmful long-term in terms of our global outlook for the pandemic is really the nationalization of our vaccine supplies and distribution. In the U.S., we are the world's current biggest hoarder of vaccines. And while, of course, it is important to vaccinate Americans, as we're seeing, it's critically important to vaccinate people in other parts of the world as well. And right now, we are still really not doing a great job of getting vaccines, not just to Brazil, not just to other countries in Latin America or South America. We're not getting vaccines to countries worldwide. There are many countries that have not issued a single dose of the vaccine yet. So we really need to do a better job of this. And the WHO, through the COVAX initiative, is working on this. But right now, we are just really a lot of wealthy countries are keeping the vaccines for themselves and not exporting nearly enough of it. So when this pandemic is over, I hope that as a global community, we'll sit down and have a reckoning about how we need to be doing this in the future. Because a pandemic, by definition, is a global crisis, not a national one.
So Vanity Fair just a couple of days reported something that helps us understand why this is happening in the United States. And I can't get into it too much, right? But I'm just going to read a quote from the report because it's a perfect example of how business and political interests work in opposition to public health interests. So this is from a Vanity Fair report from a couple of days ago. They say the contracts that the Trump administration signed with vaccine manufacturers prohibit the U.S. from sharing its surplus doses with the rest of the world. According to contract language Vanity Fair has obtained, the agreements with Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, and Janssen, that would be for J&J, state, quote, the government may not use or authorize the use of any products or materials provided under this project agreement unless such use occurs in the United States. Wow. Okay. So we could spend hours talking about just that, but hat tip to Vanity Fair for their reporting. I do want to get back to some of our listener questions. Here is Jeff, who's asking a question that we're also getting quite often on social media. This is Jeff in Wisconsin.
I am wondering if a person who has had COVID and then considered themselves immune and repeatedly entered high-risk environments, almost certainly being exposed more than once over 6 months, wondering if re-exposure to the virus reminds the antibodies to stay active.
Tara Smith, what do you think?
Yes, we think so, probably. The problem with assuming that, you know, once you've been infected and then maybe you've been exposed because you've been in high-risk environments and maybe you've been boosted from that, is that you don't really know, right? Mm-hmm. There's the assumption that maybe you've been exposed, but that's why the CDC still recommends that people who have had COVID previously still get vaccinated, just to, you know, one, assure that duration of immunity and the durability of immunity even after infection, and two, just to give that boost. So again, we don't know how long immunity lasts from a natural infection or honestly from vaccination, but having that vaccine will assure that you've had that second exposure and that, you know, your immune system is kind of boosted from that, from the vaccine.
Okay.
So that you have, again, more duration of immunity.
Got it. Well, Leland Woodbury sent us this question on Twitter. The discussion so far has made it clear that the vaccines are safe against known variants. Yay! Good. I'm so glad. But Leland says, we haven't heard any discussion about transmissibility. And Angie, to follow up with that, let's see. I thought I saw a similar question here. Okay, well, let's just talk about transmissibility, Angie. Do the vaccines prevent or reduce that with the variants?
Yes, they do, and we actually have some new data that suggests that's the case. So we don't really measure transmissibility when looking at vaccine effectiveness or efficacy in a clinical trial. And these clinical trials were done looking at disease severity rather than infection, just because that's a much quicker way of conducting those clinical trials. And we obviously needed to conduct them as quickly as possible. So the trials themselves looked at the vaccine's ability to protect against symptomatic disease. But a paper came out in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report from the CDC last week that showed that the single dose, the first dose of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines, reduces your risk of contracting an infection with SARS coronavirus 2 by 80%. And 2 weeks after the second shot, that risk is reduced by 90%. So the vaccines are very, very effective at preventing infection. If you're not getting infected with the virus, you're not going to be able to transmit it to anybody else. So based on that study, it looks like these vaccines, at least the mRNA vaccines, are very protective against infection as well as disease, and therefore should reduce transmission at the population level.
Okay, so we've just got a minute and a half left. I want to jam at least one more question in here. Tara, we've got listeners who want to know if they've had COVID but not had the vaccine, does their COVID-induced immunity include immunity to the variants?
Oh, good question. So again, you know, immunity is based on recognition of this spike protein. And even with the variants, as was discussed, even if you have a few different amino acids within that spike protein of the variants, your body is still going to recognize, you know, most of that protein, right, and respond to that, and most of the antibodies are going to work. So even with a natural infection, if you're exposed then to a variant, you still should have pretty good protection from that. But again, it depends on, you know, how distant your infection was. You will probably be better protected if you had an infection a month ago versus a year ago.
Okay. Angie Rasmussen, you're going to get the last word today in the last 30 seconds that we have. What is another sort of a misguided notion you hear in the media about the variants that you want to just do away with now and give people the right information on?
Well, I think I'd just like to follow up on what Tara just said, that you know, we hear a lot about these variants becoming completely capable of eluding the immune response. And there's actually a new paper out that shows that vaccination in previously infected people really boosts the overall immune response to really high levels. It makes it really robust. So the bottom line is that vaccination is protective against the variants. The immune system is multifaceted and complex. Vaccination enhances that. I encourage everybody to go get vaccinated to enjoy the totality of that powerful immune response.
Angie Rasmussen, virologist at the Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security, thank you so much for coming back.
It's always my pleasure, Meghna.
And Tara Smith, professor of epidemiology at Kent State University, thank you so much for coming back as well.
Thanks for having me back on, Meghna.
All right. So that's at least a little bit of Variants 101. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.